Hello and welcome to Sip Sip Hooray, the podcast where we talk about all things wine, the people who make it, the places wine grapes are grown, and the reasons why we love it. On the podcast today, words matter. What we say and how we say it can have profound impacts, and that's even true when it comes to wine. Frankly, the words we use when talking about wine leave a lot of people feeling left out. Joining us on the pod today is wine writer and educator Meg Maker to help us get to the core of what's known as wine speak and why it's time for a change. We are the two Marys who like to eat, drink, and be merry. I'm Mary Babbitt.
I'm Mary Orlin. Words may be the most intimidating thing about wine. The way wine critics, writers, sommeliers, and yes, even podcasters talk about wine can make your head spin. Wine speak can be off-putting, so hard to relate to, and definitely not inclusive. Our guest today says the language of wine needs a reboot, and we agree. Meg Maker is the founder of TerroirReview.com, and she's also an accomplished artist. But she is becoming well known for her research into the lexicon of wine, the vocabulary people use to communicate about wine, and this has sparked conversations about the way we talk about wine. Today, she'll tell us how our current wine speak came to be and her efforts to bring about a more approachable way to talk and write about wine. Meg, welcome to Sip Sip Hooray.
Thank you so much. I'm just so happy to be here. I really appreciate the opportunity.
We are delighted to have you. And this is such a juicy topic. There's so much to dig into. But I think maybe where we ought to start is at the beginning. How did we get here in this space where the wine labels, the way we talk about wine, the way the things that are written about wine all sound really complicated?
Yeah, I think that's really important to go back to that question of how we got here, because really understanding the current situation, it can be informed by so many different factors over the last 30 or 40 years in English language wine discourse. You know, we all know about Robert Parker and the ascent of the very complicated, very evocative, rich, and lavish tasting note. That was in the 80s or 90s. But even before that, what I've found in my research is that we weren't really speaking that way about wine until that particular era. We go back to Frank Pryle, who had a good long run as the wine critic for the New York Times. You know, he was really anti-wine speak. He was almost anti-flavor description. He would describe wines as chunky or with intensity. He might say a wine had bright and spicy flavors, or it had body and pronounced flavor. And, you know, that could pretty much describe half the wines in the world, or at least most of the red ones, right? Mm-hmm. And Emile Peynot, another really important, he was an enologist, a French enologist. He wrote a book called The Taste of Wine. That was a very influential tome, both among professionals and some consumers as well. And he likewise was very anti-wine speak. And yet then we had Parker, who kind of burst on the scene with The Wine Advocate, describing wines in these very lavish terms, you know, truffle and meat and sage and muscular, powerful. He was using both analogy and metaphor to describe the wine. And it was really a hit with consumers. Parker really wanted to be kind of the Consumer Reports of wine. He never accepted samples. He was all self-funded. His publication became very profitable itself. And it was really a hit, and it's spawned a lot of imitative writing, but also a lot of marketing writing took up that same banner and started becoming very lavish and very descriptive. So there was this shift, this aesthetic shift from a fairly spare way of describing wine and one that really was much more reliant on character or a sketch about what the style of wine was, towards something really quite descriptive. And notably, those descriptors were olfactory. They were what the wine seemed like to the taster. It was how they impacted the taster. So I've described this as a shift from really talking about and leaning on a wine's sort of social, cultural, historical context toward the wine's hedonic or personal impact. And that this shift was conducted kind of by the me generation. Really kind of is unsurprising in a way, but it really, I think we're still there's still a lingering impact of that shift.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I mean, it's interesting that Robert Parker has such an impact on language. I didn't realize that. You know, he's known for the point system, the 100-point system that everybody uses now, and has also been critiqued widely and problematic. But, you know, what really, and I was talking to Mary B. before we started the show, the other day I had my teeth cleaning and my hygienist asked me what I was doing, told her I wrote about wine. And she said, you know, I just don't drink wine. And you know, there's so much of it out there. It's intimidating. I don't know where to start. And so she drinks other alcoholic beverages because it's easy to understand. Mm-hmm. And I think there's a lot of problems with how wine is being communicated about that leaves a lot of people out of even wanting to try it.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think that the way, you know, wine became professionalized over that same period, meaning in order to become a sommelier, to work as a wine director or wine buyer, to work in the trade, one had to obtain certain credentials, the WSET, but also there are others as well. And those, the language of wine got kind of baked into something a little bit firmer, a lexicon of wine. And the tasting notes that are actually fairly rigidly described, you have to use those in order to pass the tests.
So that's true.
In order to become certified, to become credentialed, one uses a fairly rigid set of analytical factors to evaluate a wine and then to speak about them. And it's really hard to let those go once you've learned them, mm-hmm. because you have gotten your certification, you've mm-hmm. gotten your goodies professionally by succeeding at learning them and memorizing them and regurgitating them on tests.
Right.
So it's hard to let go of those when you're talking to a consumer, and yet it's a professional speak, as it were. So the consumers often, when faced with a professional, if that professional doesn't know how to code switch effectively, can feel very put off by terminology and language and structural notes that to us professionals, it seems natural, but to them feel fairly gatekeeping.
Yeah, they're just not, my brain doesn't call them to mind. When someone asks me about a wine, I usually draw a blank because I'm nervous. It's like being asked a math question. I forget all information and I couldn't tell you what I'm tasting. Mary Orlin, who is also a sommelier, she has the words at the ready. She can tell you, you know, exactly what a wine tastes like in her mouth. And I tend to say crispy or yummy or zippy. And I honestly have read tasting notes thinking, I need to remember this one is bright cherry. And it just doesn't come to mind. That's not how I think of wine. I know what I like, but I don't think about it in these descriptive words.
Well, yeah, right. It can feel like a test, right? A good colleague of ours, Regine Russo, she's a wine educator and she also leads tastings and for consumers. And you know, she says, even when you are open-hearted, even when you ask a consumer, what does this wine taste like? It can feel like a test because it can feel like there are right and wrong answers to that question. And I'm here to say there are no right and wrong answers to that question. That's my main takeaway here is that, yes, people love to describe what they're tasting. Some people like to do it in simple words. Some people like to do it in more complicated words. But my position is that one's authentic terminology based on one's own reference and one's own analogies and taste memories, those are really creative and really beautiful words often, and they can invite conversation in a way that saying, well, this tastes like boysenberry doesn't always do.
Mm-hmm. Meg, what inspired you to research and look into the language of wine?
You know, I've been writing about wine for over 15 years, 16 years or something. And really, I've been interested in these questions since the beginning. I've been writing about wine since I started writing about wine. Mm-hmm. Partly that's because I have a fine arts training and creative writing training. So I'm interested in not just writing, but the discipline of writing, not just language, but the disciplines of language. And I think it's a very difficult I think wine is a very difficult thing to write about. Flavor is a difficult thing to write about. It's described as ineffable, hard to describe. And partly that's because each of our unique sensoriums produces different effects in our brain, right? I taste something and you're not going to taste the same thing. I'm going to taste partly our chemistry, but also partly our own histories and everything else of what we've grown up with, for example, in terms of what we believe to be true about what's delicious and not delicious, and what things taste like and don't taste like. And so our reference points are all different. And so writing about wine in a way that allows me to describe what I'm tasting without making you feel that you should be tasting the same thing is something that I'm now on a mission to explore. And I think that a lot of wine writing has unfortunately baked in that assumption that what I'm tasting is what the wine tastes like. And I've seen that become part of that barrier that you're describing, that sense that there is a right and wrong answer to what the wine tastes like. So really, I've been exploring this really as long as I've been writing about it. I can't even remember the first time I thought this would be a good thing to pursue. However, it was about a year ago that I was asked to lead a panel at Unified Symposium, which is a professional trade show for the wine industry in North America, probably arguably the largest one. And the panel was about the lexicons of wine. And so I convened a couple of people to talk about that, and it really started getting some traction. Now, I have to say, I'm not the only person working on this. There are a lot of other people who are working on this question from various angles, and a lot of what comes up are angles about social justice and diversity, and whether we are being inclusive in the way we're talking about wine, not only with gendered metaphors or culturally problematic metaphors like, oh, this wine smells like Asian spices, which is so, problematic in many ways,
So,
right?
or this is a masculine wine or a feminine wine.
Yeah, masculine and feminine tend to be very controversial ways of describing a wine, although fairly baked into the literature now. But also, I think, so there are some sort of social factors at play, but there are also just pure aesthetic factors and pure factors about, like, is it, am I constructing a description of this wine that comes from a place of my own personality? And how can I own that description? And does that description invite engagement, right? Does it invite someone to want to know more or want to explore that wine? My objective is not to market the wine. I don't care if you buy the wine or not. My objective as someone who likes to write creatively is to present factors about the wine that I think make the wine matter. And so I need to know a lot about the wine in order to do that. I need to not only understand, well, is this wine a, Cornas from, a Syrah from Cornas, or is this a wine from Syrah from the Central Coast? I need to understand a little bit about where it was grown and who made it and why they made it and where it fits into the sort of pantheon of wines. And then I need to produce my own response to that particular wine. It becomes much more complicated. And I've just actually published an essay on my site, Terroir Review, about this question of, well, when you're confronted with 12 Cornas, how do you disambiguate? How do you actually say this one's more meaty, this one's more floral, and does that even matter? I think I'm drifting away from your question a little bit, but I think that,
That's okay.
for me, I think that what I've done recently is I've de-emphasized the olfactory qualities, which were really what professional certification programs have leaned on hard in the last couple of decades. You think about the aroma wheel, which was developed by Ann Noble. That was a hierarchy, a tiered hierarchy. It was three tiers, but it was arranged in a circle. So it was a wheel. It's called the aroma wheel. But it was really a tiered hierarchy of flavor. So there was fruit flavors, and then within that there was like citrus or berry or what have you. And then within citrus, there was lime and lemon, et cetera. And so Noble was really reacting to what she viewed as the imprecision of language that was becoming popular, like what Parker used. I actually admire Parker's lavish use of language because he was authentically writing his own sensorial notes. Like he was owning that it smelled like truffles to him, you know. Mm-hmm. He wasn't worried about an established lexicon. He wasn't worried about ticking boxes. And the thing I know about writers to be, lawyers to be true, Parker was a lawyer, is that they're really good writers. They have to know how to make a case and argument in language. And he was really good at that. And so I actually go back and I read his writing, and if you're using more than four or five descriptors, it can get a little bit baroque and kind of laughable. And
sure.
We've all seen those cartoons, yes. You know, an insouciant little one full of pretension.
Yeah, no.
But at the same time, I think that, you know, what ended up happening was a reaction to that imprecision of language and the aroma wheel first, but then the court of Master Sommelier, the WSET systematic approach to tasting wine. Those all baked in these sort of very rigid lexicons, and you had to use those terms, as like I said before, in order to pass the exams.
Absolutely. You had to commit so much to memory, and it does stay with you. I'm guilty of this, but you know, I can say that I've been writing about wine for almost 30 years. I have yet to taste a gooseberry.
Yeah, that's one that people do pick on, and because it's not a very common fruit, and it's certainly not, if you live in Southeast Asia, you know, you're not necessarily going to ever have tasted one. But I think thing is that the bulk of these lexicons is really, it's they're olfactory notes. They're flavor notes, but really when you taste a gooseberry, you're smelling most of the gooseberry. You're tasting the acid, it has an impact, and the sweetness has an impact, But really this hyperemphasis on the olfactory. So I've been trying to quiet that down because I think there are much more interesting aspects of wine, and focusing on the olfactory is a sort of impoverished way of approaching describing a wine.
Yeah. And it limits you to your own experiences, which is one of the questions I had for you. You know, as a white woman, are you actively thinking about how do I make sure my descriptors, my message, my writing about wine is welcoming all people and understood by all people? And how do you get away from your own background and your own life experiences? Or does that matter? You mentioned just being kind of trying to be honest and personal about it. You know, it just was a question that came up for me. I was just thinking, well, gosh, we don't want to exclude anybody. But, you know, as a white woman, how do I talk about this without sounding like a white woman?
Yeah, I don't think I can talk about it without sounding like a white woman. I mean, I think I need to own my reference frame. I need to own that that's my reference frame, that my cultural history, my taste history, I happen to be a French Canadian immigrant into Maine, third generation. My mother grew up speaking French. Our cuisine was based on very northern kind of cucina povera, but it was actually, that's the Italian word. But it was basically poor people's food. You know, it was boiled meats and boiled cabbage and potatoes was really my heritage. We never had wine on the table. And, you know, so I have taste memory, and I have cultural experiences that inform how I approach all food writing. And I think that the key, Mary, you've put your finger on it, that we cannot escape our history, but we can be mindful that it is our history, that it is our reference frame. And so to that end, I don't assume that someone else has tasted what I've tasted. I don't assume that they are tasting what I am tasting in the glass. And at the same time as being, you know, that ownership of my own, the personalization of my experience and owning my experience, I'm also simultaneously trying to work other channels where I'm researching what the experience is of other people and how they taste and think about and write about wine. So I have many examples that I've been tapping into to try to educate myself. Because when I learn about Jermaine Stone, for example, and what he's doing with wine and hip hop, and how he's bringing wine and like the street food together, and how he converses about that and his approach to it, it's not my approach, it's his approach. But I can learn from that. I can learn from what he's doing, right?
Gotcha. Exactly.
And so it, you know, I see that many, many really interesting people are doing some really great work. There's been a lot of work on the Asian palate, it's called, or the Asian wine lexicons. Jeannie Cho Lee has done some work on this. There's been some other work that's been done to try to recast tasting terms using cuisine reference from Asia as opposed to from Europe, for example. So Jeannie Cho Lee is master of wine. She's a wine educator, works in Hong Kong and UK. You know, she says, why should we use bacon as a reference in wine, like for Syrah from Cornas, for example, or Hermitage or something, when we have char siu? And she suggests, what about seaweed for, you know, minerality in white wines? Like, I love that idea. I mean, that really opened my mind. Mm-hmm. But she says, you know, because she's also an educator, she says, well, okay, great. You know, Chinese wine student, you're going to have to learn the standard lexicon as well as use these local reference cuisine. Mm-hmm. References, because sure. You pass the test, right?
Right. Right. And, you know, there's the Asian lexicon. There's also South American, all the different cultures, and they're so different. And then, you know, Africa, too. And I know a winemaker, she is African American. And when she describes her wines, they're commonly descriptors of flavors, foods that she grew up with. And she also pairs her wines with more African influenced dishes. So I think, you know, there's a whole world that WSET, Quartermaster Sommeliers, standard wine language leaves out.
Yeah, that's right. I know another example, Tinashe Naimudoka, who's a Zimbabwean originally, but he works in South Africa. He came in to work in restaurants in Johannesburg, and then turned out he had a rock star palate, went through WSET, became a sommelier, now actually has his own wine project and is making wine. Mm. And he said when he was learning about wine and he would have a blind tasting of red wine in his glass, and he'd say, I smell hute, which is the water berry that grows on the stream banks in Zimbabwe from his native land.
Wow.
And he'd say, well, if I smell hute, then I know that that's Pinot Noir. And so since I know that the wine in the glass is Pinot Noir, I have to write blackberry in order to pass the test.
Oh my gosh, that's so interesting.
This is like the essence of colonialism, right? Making people do duplicate work. But what I love also about Tinashe Nambudoka's story is that now that he has his own wines, he has a red blend, for example. He has a bunch of different wines, but he has a red blend that he on the back label and on the shelf talker and the tech sheets, it says, this wine tastes like hute. And then also like in smaller type, it's also maybe sort of like blackberry. So what he's doing is he's putting his own reference frame front and center, right? The point isn't that there's a correct word for what he smells in the wine or correct thing to taste in the wine. The point is that he is bringing his own reference frame. He is bringing his own set of flavor descriptors, and he's describing why. Right. He's describing why it tastes like that to him.
I love that, because we all probably hear over and over, somebody tastes the wine and says, I just can't talk about it the way you do, or, you know, a wine expert does. I mean, it's just like, you know, yummy to me. I like it, but they don't, but the language, I think, really serves to, take away their own self-confidence that I like this wine. How do I explain why I like this wine? Well, it just tastes good to me. Instead of, you know, people feel like, oh, I have to say it has notes of bosque pear or vanilla or cardamom or something like that, that they may not be able to vocalize or verbalize.
Yeah, and that might not be the most important thing that they're getting from the wine either. I mean, I think that people again, we've sold, meaning wine professionals and professional wine communicators, have sold consumers on language, on words as a way into wine. And not only words, but descriptive flavor descriptors, right? So those terms, bosque, pear, you know, cardamom, ginger. I think that there are many other ways that we can invite people to describe what they're tasting, because people do like to talk about what they're tasting. So we know that, right? And when we ask someone, well, what does this wine taste like? We're inviting a metaphor or analogy. But we could also imagine some other ways of asking about the wine, about what people are experiencing in the wine. We could say, if this wine were a car, what kind of car would it be?
Mm.
If this wine were a rock star, which rock star would it be? Which song would this wine be? We can
That's
invite
fun.
Them to make other kinds of analogies. And then we can say, you know, which Taylor Swift era is this?
Right? I love that. That's such an accessible way to talk about it.
It's accessible. And partly this is an exercise that I used to use with clients. I did a lot of communication strategy for the bulk of my career. And it's kind of a branding exercise. You know, if this brand were a car, what kind of car would it be? It's actually
right.
a fairly standard branding exercise. You know, with wine, we could also invite people to say, answer the question like, what kind of occasion would you pour this on? Would this be great for a picnic? Would you pour this at a bridal shower? You know, is this for Netflix and chill, or is this more normal wine? And then you can invite them to answer why they think so, why that might be.
I think that's fascinating. I love that. That is a great takeaway from this podcast, and I thank you for it. One of the things I think is interesting that I read, and maybe you said this, and forgive me if I don't remember exactly whether it was you, but that words have financial consequences, the way wines are described, and that the more flowery, snooty wording about wine generally makes that wine, it's associated with a more expensive wine, whereas more democratic speak, more relatable speak is associated with a less expensive wine. And I think that's fascinating because it's encouraging this snooty piece that people actively have said they don't like about wine. And yet I think the whole wine world has encouraged that. All of the estates that you visit to go taste wine. And it's like the wine world wanted this really special American wine world, this really special fancy thing. But that really special fancy thing is one of the reasons why a lot of people just feel like it leaves them cold or leaves them out.
Yeah, I think this is really interesting research. It's sort of the question of cheap versus expensive wine words. And there was originally some work done by a woman named Coco Crum. She was at MIT at the time. And she looked at the words we use to describe wine. And then Kevin Capehart, who's an economist from Cal State Fresno, went back and looked at Crum's work. And he threw some, you know, models at a wine enthusiast database of about 120,000 reviews, and wines between $5 and $200, by the way. And he found that there was a long list of cheap words and a long list of expensive words. So cheap words were things like bright, clean, fruity, tasty, pleasing, etc.
Those are my words. I love those words.
And then the sort of expensive words were things like boysenberry, butterscotch, cuvée, elegant, smoky, supple, etc. So these were more rich, more evocative, more lavish words. He also discovered that cheaper wines or less expensive wines had shorter reviews as well. And it makes intuitive sense, right? Because we can't really, you know, you can't imagine Robert Parker describing Aubryon as tasty. You know, it just doesn't, we just don't see that.
Yellow.
Yellow, exactly. You know, I mean, unfortunately, right? Because I think it is yummo. And our colleague Jancis Robinson has said, you know, this is all for professionals, right? Consumers don't need these words. Consumers can say yummo. I mean, that is almost a paraphrase, direct paraphrase from from Jancis. And, you know, Jancis is right in a way. What we've seen, though, there's a bunch of other really interesting research done by economists and marketing academics that show that these lavish use of terms has really been baked into our marketing strategies. So these words are repeated over and over. They're in the magazines. They're on shelf talkers. Our, you know, staff in an off premise are going to use these terms, and then they do again, kind of just keep adding sticks to that gate, you know, between the consumer and the wine, and making them feel a little bit like, well, I guess I can't afford this wine because it has cigars, truffle tobacco, and it's elegant and old world. And I guess this wine also isn't for me because I might assume that a wine described as old world truffle and tobacco is like a wine that is associated with an old white male privilege, And that feels like, no, I can't relate to that wine at all. That's not who I am. That's not how I self-identify.
Right. And even that term old world and new world is becoming controversial now. I've read some articles written by people saying, you know, it's time to stop saying that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, South Africa might be considered the new world, but it's a 350-year-old wine region. You know, I mean, it's, you know, another thing that I like is to just encourage consumers to use whatever expressive modes really feel right to them. We've all got, you know, a camera in our pocket. Well, if you like this wine, like, what does it make you think of visually? You know, like what image does it relate to? Or we all use emojis all the time. You know, maybe if you're going to write your own tasting notes, you can just write a few emojis to yourself. And those might be flavor descriptors, you know, a cherry and a blueberry, but it also might be a high-heeled red shoe. It might be a steak, or it might be a fire emoji, or it might be like a thumbs up or thumbs down. You know, those pictures say a lot. And so I think encouraging people to explore nonverbal means of making notes to themselves and to others, I think, is another way into this.
Well, and that's another area that you've kind of been diving into, using art as a way to talk visually about wine. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, thanks for asking about that. You know, I also want to shout out to Sarah Heller, who is a master of wine. She went to school at Yale, which has a really great, great visual art program. She was an undergrad there. And she's a painter. She's an expressive painter. And she uses expressive paintings to describe wine. She's won awards, international awards, for this work. Very interesting. You can look it up on Instagram. It's Sarah Heller, MW, is her handle. So she's taking one approach there, doing more expressive or impressionistic descriptions of wine visually. There are also some other people like Elaine Brown. Elaine Chacon Brown has
done. I was going to mention her.
Yeah, Elaine is amazing. Marissa Finetti also does wine cartoons. Those more being a little bit more narrative or descriptive, excuse me. What I'm doing is something a little different. I've got a huge photo database, so that no matter where I've been in the world, I take a lot of pictures. I'm very visual. I study visual art actually as an undergraduate. I'm a painter and a studio artist. And so what I'm doing now is, rather than use photographs to illustrate a region, a story, a place, or set of questions, I'm actually doing illustrative work. So I'm using the imagery that I gather to create, you know, kind of sketches. I first sketch based on what I've seen and what I've experienced. And then I'll do a fairly detailed drawing of the place, the people, the scene. So I just did a long set of visual essay on port wine. And really, it was mostly images that I painted to describe certain aspects of ports, past, present, and future. And it takes a lot of time. And I think I probably spent more time on the port visual essay than I spent on my entire master's thesis. It was a lot of work. But one of the things that I find is that when I'm doing this visual work, because I'm visually trained, it tends to do something in my brain to me. It tends to put me into a zone where I feel like it brings me far closer to my subject. It helps me understand the subject in a way that I didn't if I were just writing about it. It's another way of thinking. It's a thinking in pictures as opposed to thinking in words. And so I find it's really beneficial for me. It's really personally meaningful. And whether that additional meaning actually comes through in the work for others is an open question, but it has been a really important step for me to take to reintroduce the visual production into the narrative production and see how they combine. I'm still pushing on it. I mean, I've only published a few of these long visual essays, but I have used drawings to illustrate other shorter pieces as well.
Can you verbally give us an example of how you would visually tell a story about or describe a wine?
Yeah, it's not actually describing the wine. It's more describing the place and the people. So,
okay.
So for example, I did a piece, I visited Montefalco, which is in Umbria, last year at about this time for an anteprima of the Sagrantino Montefalco. And Umbria was very beautiful. I'd been all over Italy, but I'd never been to Umbria before. And it was just very rich and a very evocative place. And So the series of drawings I did wasn't really about the visual place as much. It was much more about the people I met. And so what I was trying to do was capture the people, their faces, their engagement with their wine, their engagement with their place. And so they're not descriptive tasting notes. I did, I think, include some tasting notes in that piece of wines I admired, but that wasn't the point. I wasn't centering on the wine, in other words. These visual narratives that I'm doing now don't center on the wine. They center on the story of the wine, the backstory of the wine, the people of the wine, the place of the wine.
Interesting. So Meg, has any of your research delved into the impact of AI on wine language?
You know, I haven't really dug into AI as much in terms of what it's going to do to us or what it's doing to us in terms of language. I do know that there are a lot of researchers working on tasting note databases, and those researchers so far have been principally, they've been linguists, they've been economists and statisticians. I mean, I think AI is a large language model, right? So what I've seen from the current research is statisticians and those other kind of researchers looking at large data corpuses and seeing what they can learn. With large language models, what we see is we have a huge data corpus of tasting notes, for example, and the AI is going to learn what, you know, what and how to say things about wine based on that model. So it's not such a different leap from what researchers have done by building models to go and look at databases, right? So, but it is a bigger corpus. If you're using every tasting note that's ever been published on the web by a professional or an amateur, you're gonna come up with a set of principles that the AI can derive from that, right? But what the AI derives is only as strong as the data corpus.
Right.
And it's only as diverse as the data corpus. So what we've seen in, for example, the AI models that were originally focused on picture making was there was a lot of bias baked into those pictures. It had trouble with black faces. It had trouble with certain forms and figures because there was a lot of porn on the internet, right? Uh-huh. There's a lot of porn on the internet. And that
oh
was
my gosh.
The basis, right? For this is what a woman looks like. The AI learns this is what a woman looks like based on a lot of images that are not realistic or right. pornographic. So when you think about, well, what would an AI learn about how to talk about wine based on all the wine writing that's on the internet, it's going to learn there's going to be a lot of bias baked into that.
Right.
There's going to be a lot of the words tasty, juicy, but there's also going to be a lot of gooseberry. It's not necessarily going to be, accurate. It might sound like wine writing.
Right.
It will sound like wine writing, but it doesn't mean that it's going to be more personalized, more evocative, more creative necessarily initially. It relies on doing the work, in other words, in order for it to learn.
Mm-hmm. Sure. Yeah, which kind of brings up a question for me. I asked you at the beginning, how did we get here? But I think I would like to know what your ideas are on where do we go from here? You know, how many wine writers feel like you do? How many people in the wine world agree with you and say it's time for a change and let's break free of this old lexicon of how we talk about wine?
I think it's a great question. I think when I talk about this with others, the reactions fall into two camps, basically. One camp says, this is a huge problem. There's so much work to do. I'm so glad you're working on it, you and others. And the other camp says, this is totally not a problem. I don't know what you're on about. This is just go away. And so that suggests to me that there really is some energy there somewhere. There's a story there. There's something that needs to change. I think, you know, where I come from is a place, again, where we need diversification and personalization. Diversification meaning we have to encourage all voices. We have to encourage more voices. One of my professional roles is as being part of the committee, which is board of directors in UK speak of the Circle of Wine Writers. And one of the things that I do aggressively is try to make sure that we are recruiting a diverse group of people so that we're bringing them in. I'm also a mentor to others. I try to bring new people, new voices, new perspectives into the conversation whenever I can, and also hand them experiences that I might not be able to take a press trip. You should call this person. She's amazing. Have her take the press trip. So I think encouraging a diversity of voices is really, really is profound and is really, really important to me. And the other thing is that that sense of personalization, that sense of encouraging people to use their own language. People get confused about the work I'm doing because they think that I'm saying, don't use analogy and metaphor. They're thinking that I'm saying, oh, you have to dumb down your language. They're thinking that I'm saying, you have to not use olfactory descriptors. I'm not saying any of that. Mm-hmm. I'm saying use your own and then foster that in other people's work as well. So in other words, create more richness, more diversity, you know, more elaborateness in a sense. Because, you know, we do that, we invite that for fine art, talking about fine art, we invite that for talking about cuisine, we invite it in a lot of other areas, literature. I think we need to do the same for wine and get out of those strictures of codified tasting lexicons or the expectation that we're all going to use them.
Absolutely. Or understand them.
Or understand them even. Yeah. And drive toward more diversity, more personalization, and more like personal sensibility, bring personal sensibility to an experience of wine.
Absolutely. And hopefully this will be a step in the direction of making people feel much less intimidated about wine, whether they're trying to figure out what to buy from the supermarket shelf or order from a wine list.
Yes. And I'm a huge fan of this whole notion, as someone, as I said at the beginning, has really suffered from not having the words at the ready and not being able to say why necessarily I like a certain taste. I just do. So I thank you for making it more democratic, less intimidating. And Meg Maker, thank you so much for this thoughtful and thought-provoking conversation. I believe your work is genuinely helping to bring new wine fans into the tent. And that's what it's all about. I believe those of us who love wine, we want others to share that enthusiasm. And I know the people who make wine, who work so hard to make wine, want everyone to share their love of it.
Absolutely. Thank you so much. I really appreciate the opportunity to speak with you both. These were great questions, really hard questions. There's no right and wrong answer. But I hope that encourages some people, at least in a small way, to use their own language and their own talents to describe what they're tasting.
Absolutely. And as you said, there is no right or wrong answer when it comes to talking about wine.
Indeed. Well, Meg Maker, thank you again, and sip, sip, hooray.
Cheers.
Thank you.
Well, I sure enjoyed that conversation with Meg, and I hope that it resonated with a lot of people, especially folks like me who maybe have felt like, you know, the language of wine doesn't resonate with them. They can't relate to it, and it doesn't feel real to them.
Exactly. And, you know, I can totally relate to the having the language ingrained in my brain by going through the training and the certifications and having to make the right answer to pass the exam. But I'm feeling emboldened to push that aside and figure out a better way to, you know, talk about wine. And, you know, like I always love to say, is this is great to sip by the pool or, you know, mm-hmm. on a picnic or something. You know, I like to relate an experience, and I think I'll continue to do that.
Yeah. And I even love when she talked about using emojis as a way to communicate about wine. We're so used to putting them in text to describe how we're feeling. Why not talk about wine with an emoji and give it a big thumbs up or whatever it's making you feel?
Exactly. Perfect. Yep. And in our show notes, we will link to Meg's terroirreview.com and some of her writing if you want to explore what she's been saying about the language of wine a little bit more.
Well, we hope you enjoyed the conversation today, and we hope you'll follow along and listen again. We are Sip Sip Hooray Podcast. You can find us on social media, and we invite you to subscribe to us on Substack, Apple Podcasts, and Spotify. Again, it's Sip Sip Hooray Podcast, and we so appreciate you subscribing, your ratings, your comments. All of it means a lot to us.
Right. And be sure to visit our website, sipsiphoorayPodcast.com, where you'll find our show notes, and you'll also find our past episodes in case you want to go back and binge on a few of them.
All right, Mary Orland. Well, this has been fun. Looking forward to our next conversation.
me too. So sip, sip, hooray. Cheers to you, Mary Babbitt.
Cheers to you, Mary Orland. Sip, sip, hooray.